From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After serving as Secretary of Defense and before becoming Vice President, Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton, the world's largest oil and gas services company. Now the company is the largest private contractor for American forces in Iraq. Cheney's relationship to Halliburton has raised questions about conflict of interest. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Mayer about her investigative article, Contract Sport, What Did the Vice President Do for Halliburton? It's published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Norah Jones' second album, Feels Like Home. It sold more than a million copies in its first week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling is free on a $5 million bond after pleading not guilty to more than three dozen criminal counts stemming from the collapse of the giant energy company in 2001. Skilling and Enron's former chief accounting officer, Richard Causey, are accused of lying to investigators about the company's financial troubles. Attorney General James Comey says the deceit was overwhelming.
When Enron's businesses repeatedly failed to achieve unrealistic targets, the indictment alleges that Skilling and Causey directed that the shortfall be made up through accounting gimmicks and maneuvers, many of which were concealed from investors, from credit rating agencies, from the SEC, and at times from Enron's own accountants.
Enron's former chairman, Kenneth Lay, was not mentioned in the 42-count indictment. The city of San Francisco has sued the state of California in an effort to overturn a state law banning same-sex marriages. The suit comes as the city continues to issue marriage licenses and perform wedding ceremonies for gay and lesbian couples, more than 2,700 so far. The U.S. State Department is warning Americans to leave Haiti because of civil strife that's already caused about 60 deaths. Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide says the rebel force threatening to take over the government is bluffing. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Port-au-Prince.
In a memorial service today for policemen recently killed in attacks by anti-government forces, President Aristide called for a peaceful solution to the country's crisis. He praised the police for their valor, and he quoted a dead policeman's mother. She looked at me and she said, "My boy, thank you for the courage you give me. I would be ready to fall the way my son fell if I needed to defend my country." The armed groups, as well as the non-militarized opposition, have called for Aristide to step down, accusing him of stealing elections and intimidating opponents. But so far, he's insisted he'll finish his term. Martin Costi, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said today that there's not enough time to organize national elections in Iraq before the U.S. hands over power to an Iraqi government. Annan made his announcement after conferring with members of a UN mission that went to Iraq to study the question.
We shared with them our sense, and they imagine consensus or understanding that elections cannot be held before end of June, that the June 30th date for handover of sovereignty must be respected.
Annan's position supports that of the U.S., which has said the elections won't be feasible until after June 30th, when the U.S. administration is scheduled to leave. In stocks, the Dow lost 7 to close at 10,664. The Nasdaq was down 30 to 2046. This is NPR News. The nation's largest labor federation has endorsed Democratic presidential contender John Kerry. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney announced the organization's support at a rally in Washington, not far from the White House. He told union members that Kerry is a friend of working families. Kerry said he'd work to close legal and tax loopholes that encourage U.S. companies to move their production facilities overseas. Results of a study released by the American Highway Users Alliance show that severe traffic bottlenecks have increased by 40% over the past 5 years. One of the worst cities for tie-ups is Phoenix, Arizona. Mark Moran reports for member station KJZZ.
Drivers here spend a combined total of 23 million hours a year sitting in traffic at the notorious Mini-Stack Interchange, where State Highway 51 intersects with U.S. Interstate 10 in a heavily traveled loop that circles the city. Combine that with ongoing construction, and Phoenix residents are routinely frustrated by traffic tie-ups. It's just one of a number of spots in Phoenix, now America's fifth largest city, with a so-called traffic choke point, a place where the roads aren't equipped to handle the amount of traffic traveling them. Nationwide, there were 233 such choke points this year, compared with 167 7 years ago. Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston had choke points near the top of the list, but thanks to some roadway improvements, those cities were also able to eliminate some. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Emergency officials in Texas are blaming dust storms for two traffic deaths and at least a dozen injuries in the Lubbock area. The Texas Department of Public Safety shut down some highways southeast of Lubbock while it evacuated the injured. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Allianz Life, whose vision is for all Americans to gain financial independence, providing annuities, life and long-term care insurance, and health risk management.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The relationship between Vice President Dick Cheney and Halliburton has raised many questions about the revolving door between government and private industry, and about the increasing reliance on private industry to do jobs that used to be handled by the military. Halliburton is the world's largest oil and gas services company and is now the biggest private contractor for American forces in Iraq. Dick Cheney was Halliburton's CEO from 1995 to 2000. Before that, he served as Secretary of Defense under President George H.W. Bush. In the current edition of The New Yorker, my guest Jane Mayer examines the relationship between the vice president and Halliburton in the article Contract Sport, What Did the Vice President Do for Halliburton? Mayer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the co-author of the books Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984-88, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. Vice President Cheney has declined to discuss Halliburton in depth, and you point out that even his official White House biography, which is posted on his website, notes that he's been a businessman, but it doesn't even mention his 5 years with Halliburton. Is that why you wrote this piece, because he's been so unforthcoming about it and because there's so little information?
Well, it's not really why I wrote the piece. I wanted to try to get to the bottom of the story, and I would have liked it if he had made himself available and answered some of the questions that we had about his role in helping Halliburton through the years. I mean, I was interested in Cheney because people here in Washington, you know, debate not whether he's powerful, but just whether he has more power than the president or not. I mean, he is really thought of as one of the signal important power centers in Washington and in the world right now. So I was interested in him per se, and then of course, Halliburton's become a major campaign issue. It's become shorthand for kind of cronyism and the notion that maybe the Bush administration is too close to corporate America. And so I was interested in trying to find out, well, what's the truth beneath all of this? Can we get to the bottom of it and figure out, you know, is there anything wrong here?
You say that Dick Cheney has been an architect and a beneficiary of the increasingly close relationship between the Defense Department and an elite group of private military contractors. What did he change when he was in government and when he was with Halliburton in terms of that relationship between the Defense Department and private military contractors?
Well, it's a complicated history, and I think the thing is people are looking politically for, you know, something obvious and direct, that, you know, money might be flowing directly into Cheney's pockets from Halliburton in exchange for the government giving these contracts out. And it really is a much more complicated, but in many ways more interesting story. What it is the story of over a couple decades, Cheney has long been a proponent of privatizing government, of cutting bureaucracy, getting rid of the civil servants where possible, and instead taking the business of the government and putting it in the hands of private industry wherever possible. And when he was at the Department of Defense as Secretary of Defense, he moved the department into a whole new realm of defense contracting, where they decided to hand over all of the business of supporting U.S. troops abroad to a single company. And the idea was that building barracks and feeding the soldiers and, doing the laundry, all the kind of scut work that sort of you think of as KP duty, could be done by private industry. And and not just done by many different private industries, but they decided to give all of that business, which is, it turned out to be a tremendous amount of money, to one company. And what was interesting was that, you know, I find frequently in the case of Cheney that he doesn't have a very adept antenna about the subject of conflicts of interest. And in this particular case, he had Halliburton draw up the plans and figure out whether it was possible for one company to do this kind of work. And then subsequently, Halliburton turned in a report saying, yes, we think that, you know, a single company could easily do this kind of work. And lo and behold, Halliburton then was asked to do the work. So in many ways, it defined its own market by describing the kind of work it could do and then getting all of that business, which is what happened. And so when you look back over the relationship between Cheney and Halliburton, what you see is that he put the company in the position to benefit gigantically from the U.S. military being stationed abroad. And the company has indeed made billions of dollars from this.
Was it after Dick Cheney helped Halliburton get this enormous contract from the government that that Cheney then became the head of Halliburton?
Yes, it was. So there's been a kind of a revolving door, sort of circular relationship between Halliburton and Cheney. And if you look back, you can find that I took a look at, for instance, in 1994, Dick Cheney thought about running for president himself. And I went through the FEC records to see who the donors were to his political campaign pack at the time. And among the early funders that he had were executives from Halliburton. The head of the company gave him money, and as did the head of several other companies that subsequently won Iraqi contracts. He decided not to run for president, and instead was on a hunting trip when several corporate captains were discussing the subject of Halliburton needing a new CEO. And the question came up, why not Dick? He had no business experience, but he was drafted to become the next chairman of Halliburton nonetheless. And so there is this kind of sense that there's a revolving door here where, you know, billions are being given to the company in the way of contracts, and then millions are being earned by Cheney as he's running the company.
Dick Cheney earned about $44 million during his tenure at Halliburton. What were his greatest accomplishments when he was there? What were perceived as his greatest accomplishments?
Well, actually, it's funny because the thing that he cited at the time as his greatest accomplishment actually turns out to have been something of a fiasco, which was he engineered the merger with the one of the major rivals to Halliburton, Dresser Industries. It was a $7.7 billion deal, and he oversaw it. And it was considered by Wall Street a stroke of genius for a little while, until it turned out that Dresser Industries had some baggage that nobody at Halliburton had noticed. And it turned out that there were a number of asbestos suits against Dresser, which Halliburton then inherited, which became a huge financial drain on the company. And actually, one of the divisions had to file for bankruptcy. So I was interested in that as an indication of what Dick Cheney's judgment was like as a businessman, and more in general, he's just seen as such a wise man in Washington. And I guess I wondered, you know, is he as far-seeing as we all thought he was?
You mentioned that after this acquisition, that the stock fell by about 80% in just over a year.
It did. It tanked at a time when many other stocks were also falling hugely, as Cheney has pointed out. And you know, in his defense, people have said that it would have been impossible for him to know about these lawsuits, some people have said. Though others, and in fact in this story, I interviewed somebody who was on the board, Lawrence Eagleburger, who used to be Secretary of State under the first Bush administration, who said that he thought they really should have caught this and that there was a problem with the due diligence in this particular deal. He said, I can't blame Dick Cheney in particular, but they really did slip up.
In the small world category, there's somebody in President Bush's family tree who used to be an executive at Dresser, the company that Halliburton acquired.
Yeah, I think it's the first President Bush's father was on the board of Dresser. And in fact, I think the first President Bush's first job was at Dresser. And so when this merger was engineered by Cheney, it was a kind of part of this clubby, insular world that people sort of refer to sometimes negatively as kind of a world of cronies. And I think the question to ask about it was, you know, were deals and made among friends without proper vetting, without sort of a kind of enough outside view and, you know, critical analysis? I mean, are too many things done over sort of handshakes over hunting trips? And an awful lot of decisions in the life of Dick Cheney, I have to say, have taken place on hunting trips one way or another. And so, anyway, I think that the Dresser deal raised some of these questions about, you know, whether he brings enough outside analysis into the kinds of decisions he makes.
My guest is Jane Mayer. Her article, Contract Sport, What Did the Vice President Do for Halliburton, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. In the current edition, she writes about the relationship between Vice President Dick Cheney and Halliburton, the oil and gas services company he formerly headed, which is now the biggest private contractor for American forces in Iraq. During Cheney's tenure at Halliburton, Halliburton did business with several countries that were on the list of countries that supported terrorism. Sanctions had been imposed on these countries, including Iraq, Libya, and Iran. Was this business considered illegal?
Well, actually, in one case, the U.S. government is now, the Treasury is going back to take a look at the business that Halliburton did with Iran to figure out if it was illegal. There were legal ways to evade sanctions during that period, and the legal ways were to use a foreign subsidiary, but the foreign subsidiary had to truly be foreign, and the question in the case of Halliburton's dealings with Iran, was it really a foreign subsidiary? It appears that the office was actually is shared by American members of the same company, and people are wondering whether it wasn't just a kind of a convenient dodge. And so the Treasury Department's now investigating that. In the other countries, there were, you know, the as far as we know, the company legally evaded sanctions in Libya. And in the case of Iraq, it used foreign subsidiaries that were part of this Dresser Industries, which Halliburton merged with, to do business with Iraq. I mean, and so technically, I guess you could, you know, it may be very much legal. But as far as it being a political question, though, it still seems to be, you know, raising all kinds of red flags about what kind of company was this and what kind of business was it doing.
Was it considered unusual that Halliburton was doing business with Iraq, particularly at a time when Halliburton was being run by Dick Cheney, who waged the war against Iraq in 1991?
Well, it was very unusual, and a diplomat with the UN Oil for Food program said to me that he thought it was just really strange that somehow this company, Halliburton, managed to be doing business with Saddam Hussein's regime, because the way business was done during that period was a very personal kind of choice of that was run from the top by Saddam Hussein and his sons, really. They decided which American companies they would do business with. And what this diplomat said to me was that there were very few American companies that were chosen by Saddam Hussein to do business with, unless they did sort of favors back for the Saddam Hussein regime. And so it raises all kinds of bizarre, you know, political questions about why the company was so cozy with the regime that Cheney had tried to topple when he was Secretary of Defense, and then, of course, has come back to topple since. You know, I guess in the end of the day, you have to say that Cheney wanted, when Cheney took over Dresser Industries, he said that he wanted to end doing business with Iraq. But it took quite a while before they did. They had hundreds of millions of dollars of business with Saddam Hussein's regime. And I think, you know, it shows at the end of the day that business is a different imperative than government does. It's there to make money. And it was not there to sort of do good in the world necessarily or to follow anybody's foreign policy.
When you say this relationship raises a lot of questions, what questions?
Well, I don't know how Cheney, who had sworn that he would not do business with Iraq, could have gone on for more than a year doing business with Iraq and doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business with Iraq. I mean, the question is, did he know what the company was doing? And if he did know, why did he want to keep doing business with Saddam Hussein? Many other American companies would have nothing to do with that regime.
During the Bush-Cheney administration, Halliburton has gotten enormous contracts from the government, from the military, for its work in Iraq. During Cheney's tenure at Halliburton, it got a lot more money than it had in previous years from the government. What were those contracts for?
Well, when Cheney joined Halliburton in 1995, and he stayed there until 2000. And during those 5 years, the company got something like $1.1 billion worth of loan subsidies, mostly from the U.S. government. And I thought this was fascinating. It was compared with $100 million in loan subsidies in the previous 5 years. So he just gigantically increased the amount of government subsidies that Halliburton got while he was there. And what was interesting to me was that Cheney, for much of his political career, has been a great proponent of private enterprise and kind of in some ways contemptuous of government and big government. And in this particular case, when he finally got into private enterprise, what did he do but make the business far more reliant on government subsidies? And the money in particular, it was for really unusual deals in some cases. Cheney threw himself into a deal with a company called Tyumen Oil, which is a Russian oil company, and it was exploring new oil fields in Russia. And Halliburton wanted to provide the oil services for, digging the wells and all of that sort of thing. And so Cheney got the Export-Import Bank in Washington to make the biggest loan that it had ever made to Russia. I think it was something like $400 to $500 million to this company, Tyumen Oil. But there were a lot of political problems with this because the State Department was under the impression that Tyumen Oil was corrupt. And so the State Department threw itself in front of the deal and tried to stop it from going through. And the NSC got involved at the White House and also tried to block the deal. And the CIA also got involved and tried to block the deal. But eventually, after lobbying the issue heavily, Cheney managed to get the deal through and get the loan and go ahead with it.
You actually quote a top secret document in your New Yorker piece. And I don't know if you'd see this as relating to a potential conflict of interest, but it has to do with the Vice President's Energy Task Force. Do you want to describe this memo?
Yeah, I thought this was fascinating. It is a memo that was written just about a month after the Bush administration took power. It was, I think, about February 2002. And what it shows is that there was a connection between the NSC's work that was being done in the White House about what kind of approaches the administration should take to rogue states like Iraq, and also the Energy Task Force work about looking for new sources of oil. And Cheney, of course, headed the Energy Task Force. And so this single document, in the eyes of some of the people who've seen it, raises questions about whether very early on there was some kind of connection between the war in Iraq and oil. Now, the administration, of course, has said that this war was not about oil. But this one document certainly is sort of eyebrow-raising about the kind of the coalescence of these two subjects, which seem to have been discussed in the Energy Task Force that Cheney ran very early on in the administration.
Can you tell us more about what this secret document says?
Okay. What this document says, it was written on February 3rd, 2001. It's top secret. And it was a memo written by a member of the National Security Council in the White House. And what it does is it urges the NSC and the Energy Task Force to consider melding two seemingly different areas of policy. One is to review what they called operational policy towards rogue states, such as Iraq. And the second area was to meld with that actions regarding what they called the capture of new and existing oil fields. So it looks like that they're doing is thinking about approaches to Iraq that involve a consideration of how to capture some oil fields. And so, of course, it's, you know, this is a very controversial and potentially inflammatory document. Some people who've looked at it have said they think that it seems somewhat incriminating. Other people, I have to say, who've looked at it have said, well, you know, it all it was a way of thinking about these issues, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they decided to go to war for oil or anything like that.
Is there a story behind how you got to see this document?
There is a story. I don't know how much I can tell. The reason that in the article I wrote, you don't see a name attached to that document is that the people who have it don't want it to be known that they have it. I suppose there are all kinds of legal concerns about how they got it and why they have it. And I guess maybe we can't go into too much detail, but certainly the document's authenticity has been confirmed. And it's very much like some of the things that were written about by Ron Suskind in his book with Paul O'Neill about how early the discussions took place within the Bush administration about Iraq and about opposing Saddam Hussein in some sort of military way. And here you are, this is just 1 month into the administration, really, but they are certainly talking about taking a new approach to Iraq at that point, and they are also talking about capturing new oil, sources of oil, it says.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article about Vice President Cheney and Halliburton is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. And by Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Dick Cheney and Halliburton with Jane Mayer, and Kevin Whitehead reviews Feels Like Home, the new album by Norah Jones. It sold more than a million copies in its debut week. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jane Mayer, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. In the current edition, she writes about the relationship between Vice President Dick Cheney and Halliburton. Cheney was the company's CEO from 1995 to 2000. Halliburton is now the biggest private contractor for American forces in Iraq. When we left off, we were talking about a top-secret document from a meeting of the Vice President's Energy Task Force. Cheney wants to keep secret the papers from his Energy Task Force. Over a year ago, a U.S. district court ordered the White House to produce the documents. The Bush administration appealed the decision, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. The issue of whether Vice President Cheney should hand over the papers from his task force will be coming to the Supreme Court. One of the issues there is that Vice President Cheney went on a hunting trip with Justice Scalia, and the question is, should the justice recuse himself? He has declined to do that. How does that connect to the story?
Well, again, I mean, if the question is, does Cheney have a certain kind of tone deafness to the appearance of conflicts of interest? I think you'd have to say yes, in from my standpoint, on that particular question. He's hunting with one of the justices who is going to hear his case. Now, both Justice Scalia has said there was nothing improper with this, and it's up to the Supreme Court justices to decide when to recuse themselves. A number of legal scholars have suggested that he didn't show very good judgment going on this hunting trip with Cheney. But at any rate, it just leads more to this kind of sense that I think is the reason it's become such a political issue is there's a sense in the public that decisions are being made in a very insular and clubby kind of way in privacy, and it is something that makes it a fat target for the Democrats to go after.
One of the questions surrounding Halliburton now has to do with overcharging the government by as much as $61 million in the course of buying and transporting fuel from Kuwait into Iraq. Halliburton's explanation is that this was the fault of a Kuwaiti company. Would you explain what Halliburton's saying?
I'll give it a try. It's again so complicated, but basically everybody is pointing their finger of blame at everybody else in this situation. You've got Halliburton saying it wasn't our fault. You've got the Kuwaiti saying it wasn't our fault. You've got the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers saying it certainly wasn't our fault. And one way or the other, what happened was Halliburton wound up charging over a dollar per gallon extra for fuel, which, if you think about it, just at your own gas pump is, a ridiculously high premium. And everybody that I spoke to who's expert on this said there's it's kind of no excuse in the world for paying the price that Halliburton wound up paying for that gas. And they weren't just filling up their tank. They were buying, millions of gallons. So it added up to an overcharge of $61 million. And, what everybody's saying now is, well, where did that money go? Who got the extra $61 million of U.S. government money there? The Defense Department is investigating it now. There are all kinds of tantalizing ties that come into that particular deal because the Kuwaiti royal family appears to have been somehow wrapped up in this tiny company that was involved in transporting the fuel, and people have been wondering whether they were somehow doing something corrupt.
Were you able to find out any new information about this part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, I did, what I found was a new document, a new letter, which was a letter from Halliburton itself. Halliburton had been saying that it had been forced to use this tiny company to trade with, and the letter that I found showed that Halliburton actually was recommending that they use this company, and the Army Corps of Engineers was accepting their recommendation. So Halliburton certainly seems to have kind of pushed for this at some point. It's unclear exactly why, but I think you can sort of, if you step away, what you can see as the big picture is that Halliburton doesn't appear to have been worrying too much about keeping the costs down in many areas over in Iraq.
Now, Halliburton also overcharged the government by $16 million on a bill for the cost of feeding troops at military bases in Kuwait. And last month, Halliburton confessed the two of its employees had taken kickbacks. And is this affecting the Pentagon's confidence in Halliburton or the
Well, the amazing thing to me was that it just the day after the company admitted that its employees had taken these kickbacks, the Defense Department awarded another contract to Halliburton for $1.8 billion. And I think there's a lot to be said about that, which is the Department of Defense doesn't have a lot of choice at this point. They're stuck dealing with Halliburton because nobody else but Halliburton can do the job that they're doing over there right now. As there was a scholar named Dan Gutman who is an expert in procurement, and as he said to me was, what are they going to do? Tell Halliburton to just walk off the job when Iraq is half rebuilt? They can't. So there's really not that much leverage that the government has in some ways, which is means that a lot can go wrong and will go wrong.
Now, if Halliburton is the only company that can really do this, doesn't that make the charges that there was special favors here when Halliburton got the contract, doesn't that make those charges kind of moot if there's nobody else who could have done it?
Well, I don't really see it that way. I think what it does is it raises, to me, important policy questions about whether this is a smart thing for the U.S. government to do. Originally, the reason to work with private military contractors was to bring costs down. The idea was if you work with the private marketplace, there's going to be competition, and that means that prices will drop. But if only one or two companies can do this kind of work, there's really not much competition. And so the advantages of going to private military contracts, kind of evaporate given that. There are a few things going on here, and I would say that the single most controversial part of Halliburton's role in Iraq is just one of the many contracts it has, and it's the contract that it got without any bidding. There was no competition allowed on it, and it was issued to Halliburton under supposedly emergency situations having to do with the need to go to war so fast. And this was a contract for up to $7 billion to put out oil well fires. And there are other companies that can put out oil well fires in that, there are small aspects of the work that could have been bid out and were not. And I think that's where people start saying, wasn't that favoritism? Why didn't somebody bid that part of the contract out? And why didn't Halliburton, have to compete to get that $7 billion contract?
Now, you asked a lot of people when you were doing this article if there were conflicts of interest that they saw. And one businessman with close ties to the Bush administration was talking to you about what corruption means nowadays. And would you repeat what he told you?
Yeah, I thought it was really fascinating. I mean, everybody here has that. I mean, many people that I've talked to, at least in the world of politics, they're looking for something obvious and heavy-handed. They're looking for bribes or something like that. And what this fellow said was, it's more subtle. It's not about somebody taking a bribe and giving out a contract. What it's about is the sense that the American public gets is that these contracts are being awarded on the basis of who you have dinner with. It's not what you can do, but who you know. And he said it reminded him a little bit of Russia these days, where there's sort of a kind of an inside track, and it is a political problem for the administration if they're seen as operating unfairly and just giving business to their friends.
My guest is Jane Mayer. Her article, Contract Sport, What Did the Vice President Do for Halliburton, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Jane Mayer is my guest in the current edition of The New Yorker. She has an article called Contract Sport, What Did the Vice President Do for Halliburton? Do you have a sense of how directly connected the vice president is to decisions about how the rebuilding of Iraq is being conducted.
Yeah, I found this, I was surprised by this, which is that people that I interviewed told me that that Vice President Cheney is in some ways the man to see, as they put it, about doing business in Iraq, that he keeps in touch with the officials at the Coalition Provisional Authority and talks to them about private businesses that want to come into Iraq, and he helps direct the businesses over there and tell them who to see. And so one person said to me that he's running it much the way LBJ ran the space program, and I don't know if that's really an exaggeration, but he does seem to have contacts throughout the CPA in Iraq. Old friends are sort of sprinkled through it.
Now, the privatizing of functions that were formerly done by the military, I mean, there was a time when the Army Corps of Engineers would have been rebuilding the oil wells and not a private company. There's arguments for and against the privatizing of that work. What were some of the most compelling arguments you heard on each side while researching this piece?
Well, I think the argument in favor of using a company like Halliburton is, at least originally, the idea was that you would save money. Instead of having to pay soldiers pensions for the rest of their lives and you know, take care of them, you've got this work is contracted out. And also Halliburton, it must be said, has done a terrific job in many ways. It's mobilized very quickly. It's done work that very few other companies could ever do. They can do everything from building the barracks to rehabilitating the oil fields in Iraq. And they're fast and they're efficient. They're not cheap, but they do get the job done. In the downside, though, I think to me one of the most interesting things someone said was there's a retired Air Force colonel I interviewed named Sam Gardner, who teaches at the War College, the National War College, and he said that, you know, there's a problem with using private military contractors that people didn't really think about in advance, which is he thinks it makes war too easy. When there are companies that are standing by and waiting to profit from going to war, there's really not the kind of political friction you would get if you had to order up the reserves and get them over there digging the latrines and doing the laundry themselves. I mean, and often the biggest grumbles come from the reserves and from reserves doing sort of KP duty. And this is eliminated in this new sort of streamlined, privatized fashion.
There's another issue you raise, and that is that private military companies are insulated from Freedom of Information Act requests. They can keep their work more secret, more insulated than the military could, than the government could.
Right. Well, they're private. They're private companies, and so unlike government employees, they are not bound by all the kinds of rules that keep the civil service in line. I mean, for instance, they can make campaign contributions, and take participate in campaigns in a way that civil service employees can't. They can dodge Freedom of Information Act requests. They are not bound by ethics rules that the government is. They can even, keep things like directories of who the officers are. They can keep those secret. And so it's a very different tradition. The private, profitable companies operate under different rules than the government does.
Let me ask you a question that you raise in your piece in The New Yorker. You say it's reasonable to ask if Cheney's faith in companies like Halliburton contributed to his conviction that the occupation of Iraq would be a tidy, easily managed affair. What's the question there? What?
Well, one of the things that I find fascinating at this point is why didn't this administration, which has so much experience now in waging wars in Iraq, having done it twice, why didn't they foresee all the problems they were walking into in terms of rebuilding the country? Why are we in this situation that seems to be flirting with chaos so much of the time? And I think, it seems a fair and question to ask whether it wasn't because Cheney ran a company that looked at war as it says in its own brochure these days, the war on terrorism is a growth area, as Halliburton sees it. It's a market. It's it looks like it's going to be a piece of business, really, or something tidy that you could wrap up. And really, the world has become a much more complicated place than that in Iraq. And maybe it blindsided him. I really wonder.
Now, Dick Cheney declined to talk to you about Halliburton, and he's basically declining to talk about Halliburton, period. But were there executives, current or former, from Halliburton who were willing to talk to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, everything in this piece has been run by the executives at Halliburton, and they make a lot of points. And, you know, the company has been demonized to some extent, and it does do a good job in many ways, I think. It's... and what one of the executives said to me was that the business of private military contractors working with the U.S. government is not a new business, and he pointed out that it was private companies that made the bullets for the American Revolution. So, you know, there's been a long relationship between industry and military in this country, and there's also been a long history of a lot of disturbing and troubling questions being asked about it too. I mean, it was one of the things that brought Harry Truman to national prominence were the kinds of questions he raised about the profiteering by the companies after World War II.
What are some of the difficulties writing a piece about Dick Cheney and Halliburton when Dick Cheney won't speak with you about it?
Oh, my God. It just took months to research this. I mean, it so much of the material is so hard to get a hold of. And really, the administration is so unhelpful to reporters about this kind of material. I mean, it was ironic, right, as I was working on this, Cheney was engaged in kind of a public relations offensive where he was trying to be more open, but he was only being open about the things he wanted to talk to. He certainly wasn't talking about Halliburton, and he was not open to going into any of the details about that. So it just took months and months of reading through fine print and talking to people who are obsessed with this subject. And you know, one of the things is that there are a number of people on the Democratic side on the Hill who have really been pushing this subject hard and trying to collect information. And for instance, Congressman Waxman from California. And so, you know, I spoke with them a lot, and I spoke to people in the company a lot and people who used to be at the company. But it just took a lot of kind of mind-numbing work, really.
Do you think the Democrats are going to try to make Halliburton a campaign issue?
Well, I think they already are, and I don't know how much of a sticking power it will have as a campaign issue. The Democrats would also like to hold hearings on it in Congress, but because they don't have a majority in either the House or the Senate, they've been unable to push the subject for an open congressional hearings.
And why don't you think it would have sticking power as an election issue?
Well, it may. It may very well, because really Halliburton has become this kind of code word for cronyism and for being too close to corporate America. And so I think it is, it's something that has symbolic power. But the details of it are so complicated, it's hard for people to really understand them all, I think. And also, you know, really, to be fair, privatizing the government has been a bipartisan issue in recent years, and Al Gore talked about reinventing government by privatizing government. So it's not only the Republicans who have pushed for this, but the Republicans certainly have pushed harder for it.
Jane Mayer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article about Vice President Cheney and Halliburton is in the current edition. Thank you. More than a million people bought Nora Jones' new CD in its debut week. What does our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead think of it? Coming up, we hear his review. This is Fresh Air. Singer and pianist Nora Jones's first album, released 2 years ago, has sold 18 million copies, a runaway hit, especially for a singer on a jazz label. The new sequel sold more copies in its first week than any other CD did in its debut week in 2.5 years. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead weighs in, but first, a little Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington's Melancholia from 1953. That's minor Ellington for sure, but Nora Jones heard some hidden potential and turned it into a Tony Bennett-style saloon ballad.
I hear children playing, laughing so loud. I don't think of your smile. So if you never come to you'll stay a distant memory.
That's Jones's own lyric, and while it's no masterpiece, she remakes Ellington in a convincing way, which is something, especially for a relative novice. That tune closes her new CD, a case of burying the lead. But then it'd be hard to follow up Ellington's rich harmonies with her usual blues and country-tinged fare. Jones's CD, Feels Like Home, resembles her gazillion-selling debut in many particulars, but it would have been ungracious for her to dump her loyal band after sweeping last year's Grammys. I'm not really a fan, but it's easy to hear why folks took to her sultry vulnerability, and her lush voice now sounds more seasoned and mature. 2 years of frequent gigs can make a difference.
What am I to you? Tell me, darling, true. To me, you are the sea, fast as you can be, and deep the shade of blue.
You could make your own list of Nora Jones's influences, including jazz, Depression-era ballads, Memphis R&B, and Bonnie Raitt's blues-pop hybrids. Her broad frame of reference makes for built-in crossover appeal. Garth Hudson and Levon Helm of the band The Band sit in a time or two, connecting Jones to their not-quite-placeable musical Americana, even if the great Hudson is buried in the background. Guitarist Kevin Bright's Humble Me is one of the better songs, oddly enough, because its lyric feels cribbed from several sources, like an old folk ballad. A single mom's particular tale of woe turns into a generalized prayer.
Went out on a limb, gone too far, broke down at the side of the road. Stranded at the outskirts and the sun's creeping up. Still fast asleep, dreaming of better days. that you're all I have to turn to. What do you say when it's all gone away? Baby, I didn't mean to hurt you. Truth spoken whispers will tear you apart. No matter how hard you resist it, it never rains when you want it to. You humble me, Lord. You humble me, Lord. I'm on my knees, empty. You humble me, Lord.
Some songs are weaker. There's a country ditty with guest Dolly Parton, so desperate to be catchy, I was sick of it the first time I heard it. Norah Jones's Feels Like Home must be the twangiest CD ever on Blue Note, and is part of the jazz label's partial rebranding as home to quality pop singers like Al Green and Van Morrison. This trend confirms that, commercially speaking, it's better for singers to be associated with jazz sophistication than to actually sing jazz. Okay by me if Jones sticks with original tunes instead of standards, but maybe she could lighten up on all the slow and melancholy stuff, melancholia being defined as brooding without sufficient cause. Ms. Jones, cheer up. You're rich.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Keeping Watch, a novel of psychological suspense by Laurie R. King, author of Folly. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The documentary The Fog of War, about former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, one of the architects of the Vietnam War, has been nominated for an Academy Award. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the director, Errol Morris. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.